We start out Issues Etc. today with a bit of good news coming from Washington, D.C. Yes, the government is somewhat shut down today because of Hurricane Isabel. However, the Senate made a very good decision before it decided to leave town. We're going to be talking about that with Doug Johnson here, Legislative Director of National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C., to kick off these 3 hours of Issues Etc. with you today. In about another 10 minutes, we'll be talking with Bill Beckman. A bit of bad news from the state of Illinois regarding abortion. There's a new report from the Illinois Department of Health saying that the number of abortions performed in the state of Illinois last year, 2002, went up by about 1%. Bill will tell us about that. Open Lines follows our conversation with Bill. We'll talk a bit about this First African Methodist Episcopal Church in South Central Los Angeles. Well, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State say that this church ought to have its tax-exempt status reviewed by the IRS. Why? Because of a pro-Gray Davis rally held there recently. In attendance, not only Gray Davis himself, but also former President Bill Clinton. He talked from the pulpit about stopping the recall in California. We'll have that story for you during that half hour of Open Lines. In the second hour of the program, the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. We'll talk a bit more about Paul's letter to the Colossians. And in the third hour, crucifixion and anti-Semitism. Does the gospel account hold Jews responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ? Greg Kokel will answer that question and whether or not it is cruel to say so, if it is so. That's the third hour of Issues Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Doug Johnson is Legislative Director for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. Doug, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's good to be with you, Todd.
Tell us about the bill that is now headed toward conference committee from the U.S. Senate.
Well, this is the bill that place a national ban on partial birth abortion. It's the bill that National Right to Life and many other groups have been working to try to enact since 1995. It was twice vetoed by President Clinton, blocked for another couple of years by Tom Daschle when he was the Senate Majority Leader. And now, finally, it's in the final stages of congressional approval and should go to President Bush within a matter of weeks. And, of course, President Bush is eager to sign it.
Now, I read in the New York Times account that previously, of course, as you mentioned, the Senate had refused to send this bill to conference. But why this time have they unanimously agreed to do so?
Well, the reason for a conference committee is to resolve a difference between the bills passed by the House and Senate. In this case, there's only one difference, which is that the Senate, by a narrow vote back in March, attached an obnoxious amendment called the Harkin Amendment, which is a short thing that endorses Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court opinion that legalized abortion on demand. So they've tacked on a pro-abortion resolution to the bill to ban partial birth abortion. And, of course, we want that off. We want a clean bill before it's sent to President Bush. So this is usually done pretty much pro forma. The two houses have a conference committee to iron out differences. In this case, the Senate Democrats who were opposed to the bill made a fuss about that and put us through some procedural hoops. But what the Senate finally did yesterday is vote unanimously to do what we've been trying to do for many weeks, which is to get this thing into a conference committee. And what the conference committee will do in short order is throw away the Harkin Amendment and report out the final clean bill to the House and Senate for final approval.
So what is the message being sent here by, at the very least, a slim majority of the Senate saying, yes, let's ban partial birth abortion, but a slim majority of us want to include the Harkin Amendment and affirm the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision?
Yes, well, there is a narrow majority in the Senate in favor of Roe versus Wade, if you just put the question to them that way. And yet there are on record 65 senators out of the 100, 65 senators who want to ban partial birth abortions. So there are about 18 senators who have both of those positions. Now, of course, some people will say that's inconsistent, but that's where they draw the line. And indeed, that's, we have this phenomena also in the broader public where you have 70% of the public saying partial birth abortion should be banned. But in some polls, you also get a narrow majority, at least in favor of Roe versus Wade. And I think the answer in that case, at least, is that a lot of people don't have any idea how extreme Roe versus Wade really is, the real Roe versus Wade that's been enforced by the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's a long educational process, I'm afraid.
Now, let's talk about what's next for this particular bill. You said it goes to the conference committee and then to the president's desk. Beyond that,
well, it goes to the conference committee, and then the final bill has to be passed by the House and Senate one more time in the same form. And we do not expect any great difficulty in that because it's a take-it-or-leave-it, all-or-nothing proposition at the end. It's no longer subject to amendments. And as I said, there are 65 senators who have expressed support for the bill in the past votes. And in the House, it's passed by about a 2-to-1 margin. So although there will be more speeches and denunciations by the likes of Barbara Boxer and Tom Harkin and others, some of the Democratic presidential candidates who are opposed to the bill will probably want to be heard from. In the end, it will pass, and it will go to the president in the not-very-distant future, we think.
And what about possible court challenges beyond the president's pen?
Well, that's guaranteed. After all, we do have a problem because more than half the states have already passed bills to ban partial birth abortions, but they are not being enforced right now, and that's because five justices on our U.S. Supreme Court 3 years ago said that Roe versus Wade guarantees even the right to do partial birth abortions. Even the right of, they said there's a right for abortionists to use this method really whenever they want to. Five justices said that. It was a 5-4 decision. So we can only hope by the time this federal bill gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which will take a while, that there will be at least five justices on that court who are willing to retreat or change that extreme position they took in that case.
Doug, I'd like your reaction to two things that were found in the paper as I read about this particular action on the Senate. Both of them come from advocates for abortion. The first one, not cited, says simply that this, the advocates for abortion say that if Bush signs this bill, it will be the first time that Congress has banned a safe medical procedure. Your reaction to that?
Well, of course, it's not just a medical procedure. It's taking a baby in the fifth month, the sixth month, or even later, delivering her feet first all the way up to the head and puncturing her skull and then sucking out the brain with a suction machine. I think medical procedure doesn't quite sum that up. And it's not healthy. Indeed, there's great medical testimony from all sorts of esteemed authorities that this is a dangerous procedure, even compared to other methods of abortion. So all of that, we think, is bogus.
And those who say, look, this is one of those things that, you know, I would hate to see this ever happen, and it shouldn't be there, but it ought to be legal because there may be that time when it's medically necessary.
Well, the bill itself allows for an exception if there ever was a case, and we don't think there would be, but if there ever was a case when it was necessary to save the life of the mother. But really what they're arguing is that the abortionist should have the right to do it whenever he just thinks it's the best way to do an abortion, in the fifth month, the sixth month, or even later. And nobody has plausibly explained to our satisfaction, or to the satisfaction, I guess, of two-thirds of the members of Congress, why this ever would be beneficial or necessary. I mean, you are talking about the baby being delivered until literally inches away from a live birth. Only the head is deliberately kept in the uterus. The baby is still alive up till the end of that process. What is there about that that protects the mother? Nothing, we think, and certainly it's a brutal thing to do to an unborn child.
Kate Michaelman, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, an organization that is pro-choice, says this: we've got no illusions about where this Congress and this president stand on privacy and a woman's right to choose. We are one step closer to President Bush putting the government in between women and their doctors and becoming the first president ever to criminalize a safe medical procedure. Your reaction?
Well, it's part of what they've been up to for decades, was just to try to hide the brutal realities of abortion on demand behind all of this medical jargon. And yet anyone who's looked into it knows that in the overwhelming majority of cases of abortion in general and partial birth abortion as well, it has nothing to do with medical reasons properly so-called. These abortions are done in the overwhelming majority on healthy mothers with healthy babies who, for one reason or another, wish to rid themselves of the baby. Very often there are others in the picture as well pressuring them to do so, you know, boyfriends and parents and all sorts of things. But it is, in a very, very, very small fraction of the cases, involves any true medical circumstance. And even in those cases, we do not believe that killing a child is the answer, unless it's the extraordinarily rare case in which the mother's life is truly in danger, which in modern medical practice is extraordinarily rare. There are some obstetricians who've practiced for decades who say they have never encountered such a case. But that exception is allowed in this bill and all the other bills on that the Congress has adopted in this area.
Finally, Doug, so that our audience is not left with any illusions about the temperament of the Senate on this particular issue, not only partial birth abortion, but then more generally, of course, abortion. How would you assess the leanings of this Senate at this present time on the issue of abortion in general?
Well, I think we saw that when they voted for the Harkin Amendment. If every senator had been there that day in March, there would have been 53 out of 100 senators expressing support for Roe versus Wade, the decision that legalized abortion on demand. So when people hear this overheated rhetoric from people like Kate Michelman, they need to realize that that's done for certain fundraising purposes to whip up her constituency and so on. It's not an accurate reflection of where we are in the Senate. We have a majority of the Senate that's still in favor of legal abortion, but a number of those senators are willing to look at specific issues that come down the pipe and be persuaded politically on the merits for any combination of reasons. And on the matter of partial birth abortion, as I say, there was a large group of senators who support legal abortion up to a point who said, this is beyond that point. I'm not willing to defend that. And a number of those senators are willing to support some other bills that we think are very worthwhile. We have hopes now, we hope before the end of the year that the Senate will come to grips with the issue of unborn victims of violence, the question of unborn children who are injured or killed during the commission of violent crimes. And there, too, I think there's a good chance that a fair number of senators who may support legal abortion up to a point nevertheless can be persuaded that this is a different issue and one in which we can come to agreement.
Doug Johnson, thank you again for being our guest and giving us your time here on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Doug Johnson is Legislative Director for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. For those of you who are interested, here's the website for the National Right to Life Committee. It's nrlc.org, nrlc.org. They have a phone number, area code 202-626-8800. That's 202-626-8800. That's the number for the National Right to Life Committee. We are not going to change subject, but we will be changing guests here now on Issues Etc. to talk a little bit closer to home about a new report from the Illinois Department of Health regarding abortions in the state of Illinois for the year 2002. Our guest, Bill Beckman, is Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life, based in Chicago. Bill, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Bill, what is the Illinois Department of Health telling us about the number of abortions in Illinois?
Well, the number of abortions stated for 2002 has been identified as 46,945, which is a slight increase, less than 1%, over the number of abortions reported for the year 2001. Now, of course, the reporting is always a little bit behind, since we're not talking about 2003, we're talking about 2002. But there's a very slight increase, so in reality, I don't really view that as necessarily statistically significant in terms of the small change.
So while we could track this going down and then up for the last 2 years, does this look more to you like a constant number of abortions, really, being performed in Illinois?
Given the nature of the reporting process, which is somewhat voluntary, there's really no requirement, and the fact that, like, for example, for the year 2000, the number that was originally reported was higher, and then it was reduced, that effectively, you know, if you'd use the original number, you'd be talking about that abortions in 2001 had gone down, and using the adjusted number, you're talking about abortions in the following 2 years going up slightly, that in reality, I don't think you can look at the specific number and say that it has any special meaning per se. I think there's a more important point, though, relating to this whole thing.
And what is that?
Well, I think what we're really looking at here is the fact that, you know, since in Illinois we've failed so far to get any chance of passing parental notification or the informed consent bills that have been successfully passed in a number of other states, that not having those kind of laws on the books has prevented us from having any opportunity to substantially reduce the rate of abortions, because in other states where those kind of laws have been put into effect, the rate of abortions has fallen dramatically by as much as a third in some states.
Now, I'm wondering about this because in connection with that, Pam Sutherland is quoted in the paper today, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She's president of Illinois Planned Parenthood Council.
Okay.
She said the last 2 years increases in abortion are statistically insignificant, so she might agree with you there. She says the numbers for the last few years show that women are succeeding in using protection while having sex, and I quote her, "Women are doing a great job at being great contraceptive users," and she attributes the decline in abortion since the mid-1980s nationally to a greater availability of birth control and contraception options that don't make women ill and are less invasive, such as patches and injections. What are your thoughts on her assessment of the situation?
Well, at least in the context of how that relates to young people, such as high school and college students, where the issue is expanded into the concept of teaching abstinence versus teaching, you know, safe sex. Studies have been done that totally contradict the claims that she's making based on the statistics that she's citing, which demonstrates that the actual effectiveness of the abstinence message is the real reason why there's less sexual activity and less abortions among the people in those age groups, and effectively that would contradict her claim that's really the reason. You know, it's not more effective use of contraceptives. It's basically, you know, more people avoiding sex and more, you know, or less reliance on abortion, you know, based on more of an acceptance of the abstinence message. And that's specifically prominent among the young people, which is certainly the greatest percentage of people seeking abortions.
One of the things that always concerns me, because I am a resident of Illinois, one of the things that always concerns me is the number of abortions being performed in Illinois on minors. The term is always used in the press, women having abortions. But in some of these cases, in fact, a fair percentage of these cases in Illinois, we're talking not about women, but about girls.
Absolutely.
3,100, almost 3,200 abortions performed on girls under the age of 17. What does this tell you about Illinois and its abortion laws?
Well, I mean that just emphasizes the fact that the failure to achieve the parental notification, which the first time it was successfully passed in this state, and actually the stopping block for that particular bill was the Supreme Court of the state of Illinois, because they refused to develop the necessary regulations for the judicial bypass function, and by virtue of failing to do that, they basically killed that bill. So they took into a legislative function, and basically when that bill became, you know, ineffective by virtue of them failing to implement the judicial bypass, other attempts have been made to pass another bill, and those have all failed. So we've continued down the road of not having a bill in effect in Illinois for parental notification, which is, again, a factor that's had a significant opportunity to reduce the rate of abortion in other states where those bills have become law.
It appears that the governor of the legislature of Illinois seems pretty well settled on its opposition to things like parental notification or parental consent laws. What about the people of Illinois? Is there a gap between the leaders and lawmakers and the residents of Illinois on that issue?
I believe there is, because the polls that have been done are typically done on a national basis, but you know, any polls that have been done typically show support for parental notification that ranges anywhere from like 65% to 75% of the populace. So effectively, the people of Illinois are, I believe, you know, clearly in a different mindset than the current leadership of the Illinois government.
Is Illinois, and if you take my meaning correctly, an exporter of abortion, given the fact that the number of out-of-state abortions that were performed in Illinois are almost 10% of the total?
Well, it is true, because all the surrounding states to Illinois do have parental notification laws in effect. And so there's certainly a concern that there are a number of cases where people are thinking that abortion is what's necessary and bringing without to evade the parental notification laws of their own states, bringing underage girls into Illinois for abortions. The partial good news on that is that the rate of out-of-state women getting abortions in Illinois has actually fallen. It went from 4,852 in year 2000 to 4,207 in the year 2002. So apparently the fact that there has been a lot of push at the national level for a law to make it illegal to do that transportation of young girls across state lines has at least potentially had some impact, just talking about it, on people saying, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, and because the fact is that we've got a reduction of over 600 in comparison to 2 years ago in out-of-state abortions in Illinois.
I'm looking at this county by county, and what strikes me is that there's only about a third of the counties in Illinois that actually report abortions. How does that stack up, do you think, against other states? Is Illinois...
Well, go ahead. It's a very deceptive thing, because the fine print at the bottom says that they don't report for counties where it's less than 50. So all those asterisked out fields, actually, there are should be numbers in there, but for some reason, based on how they do this, they're not willing to report those numbers. So, because if you add up the totals, I mean, there's only, like you said, there's only about 20 counties that are actually reporting numbers, that doesn't come anywhere near the state total.
Give us your thoughts, with about a minute left here, on the accuracy of these figures and the ones nationwide, since there is no state or a national regulation that I know of that says you need to report every abortion and this is how you do it in a regular fashion so we know how many are being performed.
Well, yeah, these numbers are actually probably low because these are the ones that get fed to the national level, to the government, you know, the Center for Disease Control, and the numbers that they report for abortions, like for the last year they reported, were under, like, you know, somewhere in the 900,000 range, under a million for certain. And the Guttmacher Institute, which is an arm of Planned Parenthood, which keeps statistics, has always reported much higher numbers of abortions. So their number for, like, the last reporting year was, like, something closer to 1.3 million. So that's, like, at least 300,000 to 400,000 higher than the ones that are effectively reported to government agencies. And so they're getting their statistics directly from the abortion providers, who are apparently more willing to report their statistics to Guttmacher than they are to the government. And so the numbers are substantially higher. So in that sense, if you do an extrapolation, the odds are that the Illinois abortions could be as high as maybe another 10,000 to 15,000 abortions actually performed here.
Bill Beckman, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc. Keep up the good work out there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bill Beckman is Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life, based in Chicago. You can contact them at area code 312-422-9300, 312-422-9300, or you can check out their website at illinoisrighttolife.org, illinoisrighttolife.org. When we come back, open lines for your questions and your comments.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What is Christian freedom? What does St. Paul mean when he writes to the Colossian Christians, "Whatever you do in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ"? What does it mean to do something in the name of Jesus? You'll find answers to these questions and more in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. You can order the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians online. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians.
Now, Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on widows living among the countries of Africa. Caring for them is one way of sharing Christ's love. Women who have their husbands die face a tremendous burden in different countries of Africa. It's hard for them to support their families, and their chances of remarrying are quite low. But this is one group that has the attention of EBM International, a mission agency whose goal is to make Christ known to the whole world. Getting help for widows is one of the creative ways that missionaries with EBM use to share Christ's love. In addition, higher education and health clinics also play key roles in EBM's ministry strategies. Pray that women in Africa whose husbands die will get the needed resources to sustain them and their families. Get more information with a mission packet from EBM. Call 1-800-804-9524. That's 1-800-804-9524.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Back in science class, did you ever hand in an experiment and attribute the results to God? Of course not. A scientific understanding of the world depends upon natural cause and effect, things which we can discover and quantify. So when the media reports on Isabel, we hear about the natural phenomena of the storm, not about God. Read the Bible, however, and you find yourself in a different worldview. Jonah 1:4 says, "The Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and a violent storm arose." Nahum 1 verse 3 says, "The Lord's way is in the whirlwind and the storm." Two different worldviews. Do they leave you spiritually schizophrenic? Is God involved or not? If God is to be relevant to your life in our scientific age, there must be some places where he steps into the closed world of scientific cause and effect and makes a difference. The Bible suggests several breakthrough places: the coming of his Son into flesh, sacraments, biblical revelation itself. And sometimes, if he so chooses, he can reach down and calm a storm. Is your God involved?
Ever wonder what you can do with that painting from Aunt Sophie? Wonder no more. Donate those unused or overused art pieces to Lutheran Family and Children's Services of Missouri for its upcoming art market. It'll be held during LFCS's Family Walk Fall Festival on October 4th at Concordia Seminary. Bring your paintings, sculptures, decorative frames to the LFCS office located at Del Mar and I-170 between 8:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday.
Welcome back. We're right in the middle of this first hour of Issues, Etc. Coming off those two conversations with Doug Johnson and Bill Beckman, both having to do with abortion, I feel the need to reiterate something that I pointed out yesterday and to pick up on something that Beckman said just a few minutes ago about the inaccuracy of the reporting of abortion figures nationwide. It's commonly understood, because there are such large discrepancies between, like, the Guttmacher Institute's numbers, which number around, well, we're talking for the average year, maybe 2001, the latest reporting period, 1,000,003 abortions for that year nationwide. If you look at the Center for Disease Control numbers, they have 860-some-odd thousand abortions. That's a pretty big discrepancy. We're talking about a 500,000 abortion difference there. Okay? That's the first point to take away here. Yesterday, I pointed out that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, had reported the infant mortality rate in the United States dropping. Now, the United States has, for an industrialized first world power, pretty high infant mortality rate compared to, say, the third world, where their rates are high, but there's a lot more disease, there's less help for the people, less sanitation, the infrastructure doesn't exist, things like that. But if you compare the United States with other industrialized countries, their infant mortality rate is high. Some Western European countries, their infant mortality rate is 0.003%. Okay? That is three one thousandth. One, is that right? It's three babies out of every 1,000 die at birth, at or before birth. The United States, at least according to the CDC figures, is about 7 babies for 1,000 die at or before birth. The actual figure is 0.0068%. And you say, that's a very small number. Well, it is. 7 out of every 1,000 babies die at or before birth if you don't take into account abortion. If you take into account abortion, the number of babies that die at or before birth in the United States skyrockets. And I'm not just talking about goes up significantly like 1 or 2% or 10%. If you take the CDC figures, which we do not count abortion in the infant mortality rate, you get this 7 out of 1,000 babies. If you figure in the number of abortions, low estimates, the CDC's numbers, 860,000 for the year 2001, 18% of American babies die at or before birth. 18%. That's a lot of babies. Now, if you take the Guttmacher Institute's numbers, which are about 1,000,003 abortions in 2001, that percentage jumps to 21%. 21% of American babies, 210 out of every 1,000 die at or before birth in the United States. I'm not making these things up. And in fact, the numbers that I ran yesterday when this news came out from the CDC, I purposefully took the low estimates. I purposefully used the Centers for Disease Control figures rather than the higher figures. The Center for Disease Control says in the year 2001, there were about 2,300 abortions a day in the United States. Some people are estimating that at about 4,000 a day. And those aren't estimates that are coming from pro-life groups, by the way. Those are estimates that are coming from organizations that support abortion, about 4,000 a day. 21% of all babies in the United States in 2001 died at or before birth, and the vast majority of those babies died at the hands of an abortionist. That's an unbelievable infant mortality rate. That's higher than some third world countries. That's almost as high as the infant mortality rate in centuries past. You have to go back literally hundreds of years to surpass that infant mortality rate. You have to go back to times like the Reformation, 500 years, the Renaissance, before that, the Middle Ages, where maybe you got into the 30s or the 40% of children died at birth. You have to turn back the hands of time to a more primitive, less civilized age. I put those in quotation marks. In order to get an infant mortality rate that matches or exceeds the actual infant mortality rate in the United States today, because of abortion. Just something to think about. It's open lines, issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here's the story that caught my eye. I heard somebody talking about this morning. And this is one of those that if you first just start reading it, the most interesting part of the story, well, who knows? Who knows what you might think about this? I'll do that. Let's start reading at the middle of the story. And this is, I'm picking up where Robert Boston, he's an assistant director of communications for this organization, pilloried and demonized by the religious right on a regular basis, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Robert Boston has this to say about what happened at a church in South Central Los Angeles recently. I think it's pretty clear that this was a political rally. And while that may be fine in some venues, it's not okay for a church. Nonprofit organizations, including houses of worship, are not supposed to be involved in partisan politics. Now, does this surprise you at all to hear this coming from a director of communications for Americans United for the Separation of Church and State? No, of course it doesn't. He goes on. He says this. They all agree on the fact that the politicians involved appealed for votes. I think that the appropriate thing to do here would be to turn this church into the IRS and ask them to examine this church's tax-exempt status. The church they're talking about is First African Methodist Episcopal Church in South Central Los Angeles. And at this point, you might be saying to yourself, there they go again, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Some well-meaning congregation brought out a politician to simply air his views on a Sunday morning, and the pastor might have inadvertently said from the pulpit something like, you know, this is a good man and he deserves your vote. The politicians involved Gray Davis and former President Bill Clinton. Here's the whole story. The First African Methodist Episcopal Church in South Central Los Angeles may be headed for a tax problem as a result of a rally held Sunday for California Governor Gray Davis. The group, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, says that it has filed an official protest with the Internal Revenue Service requesting a review of the church's tax-exempt status following a Sunday worship service that turned into a political rally for the governor. The rally featured the governor himself and perhaps the biggest Democratic heavyweight in the country, former President Bill Clinton. The former chief executive endorsed Davis from the pulpit of the church. Now, according to federal law, churches and other organizations with a 501c3 tax-exempt status are barred from engaging in political activities on behalf of or against any candidate for public office. This is one of those things that usually has Christians up in arms saying that this just shouldn't be. We shouldn't have to revoke our tax-exempt status in order to favor a candidate on a Sunday morning or hand out voting guides on a Sunday morning. But I think that Americans United for Separation of Church and State are applying the same sauce to the goose as to the gander in this case. They're not going after a conservative church. They're not going after a church that is predominantly in favor of Republican lawmakers. They're not going after them for having John Ashcroft in the pulpit. They're going after them for allowing Bill Clinton into the pulpit to endorse votes in favor of overturning the recall vote of Gray Davis. All's fair. Now, if you want to applaud this, folks, let me just put a little break on this. If you want to applaud this, you should also be applauding when they seek to review the tax-exempt status for conservative churches that have Republicans standing in their pulpit around election time. Or if you want to decry their actions when they come after the tax-exempt status of pro-Republican churches who misuse the pulpit for political purposes, then you need to decry this as well. When pro-Democratic churches use the pulpit for political purposes. In other words, folks, be consistent. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's a difference here that I'm just not seeing. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jay is on the line. Jay, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well.
I've got a couple of questions. First of all, the difference between 800,000 and 1.3 million, I mean, it's a big number, but both of those are big numbers, and it just seems surreal to me almost that we could be killing that many babies every year.
They're both. One is too many. They're both mind-boggling. You're right.
I just can't hardly get my brain around that. But my first question is, I've been invited to an event for a politician that involves a donation. I need to find out if the person does or does not support abortion. What's the best way to find that out?
Well, is it a local politician, a national?
A state politician.
A state politician. The best thing to do is to go, where's your residency, Missouri, Illinois, some other state?
Missouri.
All right. Go to Missouri Right to Life. Go to their website. They generally, all people registered either to run or who hold public office, they generally have a scorecard on all of them.
Okay.
And they will tell you either how they voted or what views they have expressed there. And it's a pretty accurate read. This is their business. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it's MissouriRightToLife.org.
Okay.
All you have to do is just put in Missouri Right to Life into a search engine. They'll take you right there.
Okay. The other question, thank you. The other question is really a Bible question, and I'm sure it's come up before, but I've never heard the answer. The passage in Exodus that talks about a woman losing her child as a result of some blow, it doesn't use the word abortion, but it's similar. And then the penalty for that is not the same as for murder. I'm not sure how to respond to that, and maybe this isn't the right form, but I'm sure you can give me an answer. I hope you can.
Okay, so what you're asking here, Jay, is how has someone approached you and said, look, even in the Old Testament, the penalty for the accidental killing of a preborn baby isn't the same as that of murder?
Right.
You're wanting to know how to respond to that?
Yes.
All right. Jay, thank you very much for the question. I'll do my best. Now, what I might have to do to give you a fulsome answer is to actually look up the passage, and I think these are probably found somewhere in Deuteronomy or Numbers. Look up the passage that actually describes both the penalty and the crime. One thing to note, without having the passage in front of me, is this. Those Old Testament civil laws and criminal laws did recognize very clearly between intentional and unintentional killing, either of a person or, as in this case, unintentional killing of an unborn baby. You strike a pregnant woman, she miscarries. What's the penalty? I've read through these passages before. There's a big difference between an accidental killing and an intentional killing. Even our law today recognizes the difference between murder and manslaughter. Even our law today says you're driving down the road, you accidentally have a car accident with a pregnant woman, she miscarries, the baby dies. That has a lesser penalty. So first of all, there's a recognition there between the accidental and the purposeful. No one could make an argument, so that we get off on the right foot here, no one can make an argument that abortion is somehow an accidental act. It is entirely purposeful. It is intentional in every sense of the word. Now, rather than go searching around here, I'm going to look in the most likely spot. And not finding it immediately, I will have to defer that question until I have an opportunity to look it up. It's very difficult to look up a Bible passage and do a radio program at the same time, but I will answer that question. Jay, thank you very much. You know what I find fascinating, though? Someone who's trying to justify abortion on the basis of the Old Testament. The Bible, period. One of the basic principles regarding the taking of life, and this predates even the giving of the law to Moses, to the people of the Old Testament, to the Israelites, one of the basic principles is found right after the account of the flood in the book of Genesis, where God establishes that the taking of the shedding of blood, the taking of a life, an innocent human life, is a crime serious enough to deserve death as the penalty. Now, that's the basic principle, and that is not a principle violated by any subsequent law in the Old Testament, or in the New Testament, for that matter. So let's see if the old let's defend abortion on the basis of some law in the Old Testament that might have allowed a lesser penalty for a baby killed in a violent act, an unborn baby killed in a violent act. Well, there are two parties to this killing. Actually, three. The one who commits the killing and the two who suffer as a result. The baby dies. In order for someone to argue from that, if such a passage even exists, they would have to say that the baby is not innocent. And I'm speaking in purely in moral terms. They are not an innocent party. They must have done something to deserve having their blood shed. Sad to say, there are some advocates of abortion today, without making resort to the Bible, who actually do talk about the infant being an intruder, a parasite, if the mother does not want the baby in her womb. A hostile aggressor. And the woman is simply acting in self-defense. So don't think the argument isn't being made, for heaven's sakes. Joyce is on the line. Joyce, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. You're talking about abortion, I know, but this is also a right to life, and I'm just calling about Terry Shinner Schiavo, the lady in Florida that you were talking about last week, I believe it was.
Yes.
Well, I just went on the website, and the judge has ordered her feeding tube to be removed October 15th.
Mm-hmm. And I read the same thing too, Joyce. This is not unexpected. When we talked with Wesley Smith about this, he said this would likely happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other hope here, it appears, because I wrote Jeb Bush about this. And Jeb Bush sent back a very nice form letter. Actually, one of his assistants sent back a very nice form letter that simply said, well, the governor's done all he can do. And, you know, we tried this once. We wrote a letter. But this is really a case for the courts. Unless there is a superior court there who is willing to stay this, and it doesn't appear that there is in Florida, she only has a matter of weeks.
Right.
You're absolutely right. It's a sad story.
Yes.
Joyce, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I had something sitting in the pile here, of course. I actually had the letter from Jeb Bush, at least his office, and I must say I was profoundly disappointed. I wrote, like many of you did at the behest of Wesley Smith after that conversation, to the governor down there in Florida, Jeb Bush, about this young lady whose husband was granted guardianship of her after she suffered some sort of an attack and was rendered mentally incapacitated. Her husband was awarded guardianship of her by the courts on the basis of the fact that he would care for her for the rest of her life. He received a malpractice settlement, a large sum of money. I don't remember the actual sum. $750,000 comes to mind. The money was no more in the bank than he began to work to withhold care from his incapacitated wife. He's living with a girlfriend while still married to his wife. He's had children by this girlfriend. He has consistently refused even the most basic care for his wife. He has put her in hospice, even though she's not terminal. And he got this judge down in Florida to order that her feeding tube be removed. They're going to starve and dehydrate her to death. It was supposed to begin September 11th. I don't know if the judge put it off a little bit, but it certainly has begun. It's very clear that this woman's husband wants his wife to die so that he can get what's left in the trust, $750,000, and go on with his life. And the judge apparently cannot see this. And all that was being asked was that the judge simply permit someone else to be guardian ad litem for this woman because there was a serious conflict of interest between this man, her husband, and this woman laying there in an incapacitated state. I was profoundly disappointed that, having contacted the governor down there, their office returned the message basically saying, look, there's nothing we can do about this. Now, there might not be anything they could technically do about it, but of course, the governor does have the bully pulpit. Ralph is on the line. Ralph, welcome to Issues Etc. Our time is very short. Ralph, welcome. Ralph, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, welcome to Issues Etc. Our time is very short.
Yes, the passage that was referred to earlier is Exodus 21, verse 22 to 25. And it's important to note that there's a distinction. It says not that she miscarries, but that she gives birth to the fruit of her womb. And then there's a distinction between if there's no serious injury or serious injury. And if there is serious injury, it's life for life, etc.
Ralph, thank you very much. In fact, while I was making a previous comment, I had come across that very verse. And let me read it to you in the time left to us here. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman, so it's an accidental act. They're going after one another, but they hit a pregnant woman, so that her child comes out or her children come out, but there is no harm. The one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay what the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay proportionate to the crime. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Nowhere in that passage that I can see, and thank you very much, Ralph, is there any excuse for abortion. In fact, if one wants to make any argument and say, okay, let's say abortion is somehow an accidental act in which a baby just kind of happens to die unintentionally, laying aside the fact that abortion is intended only to kill the baby, if that even that were true, there still would be required by that passage there, if you want to argue from it, a proportionate punishment for the one who's caused the harm. When we come back from this break, we'll spend in our second hour of Issues Etc. a full hour talking about the book of Colossians, the history of the formation of the Colossian congregation, the ministry of the church and the authority and interpretation of Scripture, all in the book of Colossians. Dr. Paul Dieterding is our guest when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.